After several weeks of discussions about local political problems, we turn now to a somewhat larger issue, the question of banning further nuclear weapons testing. And we shall talk today with a distinguished scientist who has been in the forefront of the campaign to bring about such a ban, Dr. Linus Pauling, professor of chemistry at the California Institute of Technology. Dr. Pauling, some of your predictions seem to be coming true.
Yes, I must say that I'm very much pleased with the way that things have been changing during the last 2 years in the attitude of not only our own government, the United States, but also of Great Britain and the USSR toward this very important matter.
Well, to what do you attribute this change in attitude? Is it just a growing awareness of the dangers involved?
I think that there are several factors involved in it, and one of them is a growing awareness of the factors, the possibility that the world would be destroyed if there were to be a war. There's no doubt that a great nuclear war would leave the United States and the USSR and most of the countries in Europe unrecognizable, with most of the people killed. There's no doubt that our national leaders, the leaders of all of the nations of the world, know this now and recognize that the only course that they can follow is one that prevents war, leads to the international control of nuclear weapons and to the solution of world problems by a means other than war. Now, as to other factors that are involved and as to how it has come about that our national leaders in all of the great nations recognize what the situation is, I myself think that the scientists have had a great deal to do with it, and in particular that Dr. Killian and Dr. Kistiakowsky now, who is his successor as a science advisor to the president, and the committee of scientists set up as the advisory committee to the president, have played a very important part.
But really, much of this was known 2 years, even 4 years ago, when there was a suggestion made that we stop banning, stop testing atom bombs. As I recall, that was greeted with a good deal of denunciation, some abuse, quite a bit of ridicule.
Yes, that's right. And it's hard to know just why it is that this sensible proposal, which was, of course, advocated 4 years ago by Mr. Stevenson, a proposal that we formulate and accept an international agreement to stop the testing of all nuclear weapons as a first step toward a more general disarmament in order to stop the pollution of the atmosphere and also to get some control over the continuing development of nuclear stockpiles. As to why this proposal wasn't given more serious consideration, it's very hard for me to understand. I think that it was in part the result of ignorance, not only on the part of the people, but also on the part of the government officials. It's about 2.5 years now two and a half years ago that the Office of Science Advisor to the President was set up. And it didn't take very long, not more than 6 months, 8 months after that office was set up, for the government's official attitude to change in a very surprising way.
Well, Dr. Pauling, as I recall, when you began your active evangelism on behalf of a ban, the main concern then was the effect of fallout. Now, however, it's considered sort of an opening wedge toward a general attitude of trust, possibly leading to further controlled disarmament. Do you see it as the first step?
Oh, yes. I see it as the first step. Only one step, but an extremely important step, partially because it would be the first one. By the way, my active evangelism began in 1945. This is evangelism against nuclear war. It was clear to me, as to many other scientists, Professor Einstein, for example, that the atomic bombs, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, which could destroy completely a moderately small city, a city such as Minneapolis, say, were so destructive that it no longer made sense to settle questions by waging war. There would be so much destruction done on both sides in a nuclear war fought with atomic bombs that clearly the sensible thing to do was to find some way of running the world's affairs without causing so much destruction. Well, I'm not sure that this campaign would have been successful. I rather doubt that it would have been successful if it had not happened that an extraordinary event occurred in the period from 1952 to 1954. This was the period during which super bombs were developed. On the 1st of March 1954, we exploded the Bravo bomb at Bikini. This was the first super bomb. It was a three-stage bomb, fission, fusion, fission, with a tremendous amount of explosive energy, 1,000 times as great as the explosive energy of a Hiroshima or Nagasaki bomb, energy equal to 20 million tons of TNT. This one Bikini bomb had 7 times the explosive power of all of the explosives used in the whole of the Second World War. Well, when this bomb was exploded, I think it became evident to everybody who knew the facts that there was no longer any doubt whatever about the irrationality of war in the world.
No longer any doubt about it, probably.
That's
on
right.
Both sides, but still the problem remained how to pursue this course and yet at the same time
That's
safeguard
right.
the security.
And,
it's quite
it's
a dilemma,
clearly,
isn't it?
A very difficult problem. Now about safeguarding our security, you see, we're not very secure as it is, because if a nuclear war were to break out tomorrow, day after tomorrow, we'd be dead without much doubt. We'd be still here in Chicago. A bomb without doubt would drop in Chicago or within 50 or 100 miles of Chicago. One of these 20 megaton bombs exploded over a city, smashes it flat over an area 20 miles in diameter. There's very little chance that the people in this area would survive. In addition, it spreads local radioactive fallout over an area of about 10,000 square miles. It would be possible for a bomb to explode 100 or 150 miles from Chicago, and with the wind blowing toward Chicago, the local radioactive fallout could kill almost everybody in Chicago. 300 of these bombs exploded over the United States would kill most of the people in the United States. So that I don't think that we can say that we must preserve our security. We don't have any security. We have no way of keeping the Russian rockets and bombers and submarines from bombarding the United States. They have no way of keeping ours from bombarding them. You know, the president said, well, I'll quote Mr. McElroy when he was the Secretary of Defense. He said, even if Russia were to launch a gigantic nuclear attack on the United States, we would still be able to destroy Russia completely. Mm-hmm. And of course, Mr. Khrushchev has made similar statements. No matter how powerful an attack we were to launch on the USSR, they would be able to destroy us completely, and most of the rest of the world. Much of the rest of the world would be destroyed, too. The worldwide fallout would cause immense damage. This is really, it's hard for me to believe that I live in a world that has got itself into the fix that we are in now. We aren't secure now. We are probably right at this moment at the time of maximum insecurity for our nation. And from now on, any international agreement that we make that gives even a minimum amount of control of nuclear weapons is going to increase our security. It doesn't need to be perfect. It's impossible to have things perfect in the world. But a good agreement will do a great deal to make the world a safer place for the United States.
Well, isn't this really what everybody has been striving to achieve a good agreement to safeguard the security of the United
That's
States
right.
as well as that
That's
of the
right.
Soviet Union.
Yes.
And yet the problem is to reduce this to terms to which countries can put their signatures.
That's right. And you might ask, why is it that this agreement, which my scientific colleagues and I advocated very strongly 2 years ago when we presented our petition to the United Nations, why is it that this agreement, which has been now worked on for 16 months by Ambassador Wadsworth of the United States and Ambassador Chirapkin of the USSR and Ambassador Wright of Great Britain, three very good men, there's no doubt about that, still isn't made? Well, this is a complicated question. First, I want to mention the statement that you made about our advocating that an international agreement to stop the testing of nuclear weapons be made in order to stop the pollution of the atmosphere with radioactive materials. What my colleagues and I said was that we urge that this international agreement be made, and we didn't urge a unilateral cessation of weapons tests, but rather making an international agreement to stop the testing of all nuclear weapons all over the world in order to stop the pollution of the atmosphere, which causes damage to the pool of human germplasm such that defective children are born, and also causes people to die of cancer. Yes.
Well, you were not advocating
cancer. But we also said, and moreover, this would be the first step toward preventing the spread of stockpiles of nuclear weapons to more and more countries, which can only increase the danger, would only increase the danger of outbreak of a devastating world war, nuclear war, that would mean possibly the end of humanity. And also that it would be the first agreement, I would hope, in a series of agreements that would lead ultimately to effective international control of nuclear weapons and to general disarmament and the abolition of war. We advanced all of these arguments in our petition.
Well, do you think that you can stop the spread of atomic weapons to other countries?
Oh, yes, I believe so.
How? In what way? What is to prevent, let's say, any nation now? Any nation with reasonable scientific material from developing its own bomb?
At the present time, there is nothing to prevent them. And, of course, unless we start making international agreements and get nations to sign these agreements, agreements that they will not make, carry out atomic bomb tests, and that they will not make nuclear weapons and build their stockpiles. And, you know, they have to be shown some reason why they shouldn't do this. France is an illustration of the fact that unless we start doing something about it, there will be more and more nations who have nuclear weapons. Within 10 years, 12 years, there would probably be 20 nations in the world who have great stockpiles of nuclear weapons, each one of which might be enough to kill nearly everybody on Earth. I have estimated, and nobody has denied that my estimate is a good one, that the United States has 100,000 nuclear weapons in its stockpile, and the USSR perhaps 50,000. Now, many of these are small nuclear weapons like the Hiroshima or Nagasaki bombs that would only kill 100,000 or 200,000 people, but I'm sure that thousands of them, perhaps even 10,000 of them, are great megaton weapons such as the 20 megaton bikini bomb, powerful enough by itself to destroy any nation in the world. This is the state that we are in now. There is the possibility, really, that our nation would be completely destroyed and almost all Americans killed, and similarly, that Russia would be destroyed and almost all Russians killed. And this is the one fact that we have to recognize and to start to keep always in mind in our international relations. Now, in Geneva, for 16 months, negotiations have been going on, and there has been astounding progress. For one thing, you know, the USSR has relied very much on secrecy. We don't know where their great installations are. This is part of their defense. It isn't part of our defense, but it's part of their defense. And yet, 8 months ago, the USSR agreed to allow inspection teams, inspection stations to be set up inside the USSR, and inspection teams to make inspection trips back and forth on a veto-free basis. Well, this is an extraordinary concession that they have made. We have made concessions too. And our negotiators and the Russian negotiators have approached more and more closely together until now they are so close together that really the differences between our proposals are almost negligible. I would be satisfied with either the USSR proposal or the United States proposal as it
you
stands.
Would name?
I would be satisfied with either one.
Provided both sides agreed.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Provided that it were accepted. And I think that probably a compromise, which is a sort of intermediate proposal, would be the right one to accept now. But the differences are very small.
Well, the only difference seems to center about the question of underground tests, the so-called small tests, which the United States has indicated some desire to continue.
Yes.
And the Russians are proposing that we stop. We can't detect these tests, can we? The small underground type.
Well, it is difficult, more difficult
yes.
to detect.
So there's a question of faith involved
tests.
Here, is there not?
There's a question of faith.
Good faith. Trust.
Good faith and trust. That's right.
Are you willing to try it, Dr. Pauling?
Well, I
we
think
have no
we
other
are
choice.
Forced to do it. I would prefer to have a system of inspection stations set up that would check on everything. And I think that we can get that in a few years. It may involve a much more personal inspection, on-site inspection than is talked about now. But I think that as we move toward general disarmament, we shall have to have a great deal of on-site inspection. And I think that as we move forward into the world of the future, which is going to be a safer world for the United States and for the USSR, there will be less reason for the USSR to put its great trust in secrecy.
But first of all, there must be some demonstration of faith. Is that what you're suggesting?
I don't know that there needs to be any demonstration of faith. No, I think that we are in a situation where we and the USSR, too, are forced to make international agreements about nuclear weapons. And since we are forced to do it, there's nothing that needs to be demonstrated. On the other hand, I think that the agreement that should be made now, which I think must be an agreement to stop the testing of all nuclear weapons.
Of all types.
Of all types, including explosions underground, even of small bombs, is one that can't be checked up on with complete certainty. And I think that the proposals that both the United States and the USSR have made are good ones, namely that we make the agreement to stop the testing of great nuclear weapons forever with a system of control and inspection stations. And in addition, we pledge ourselves not to carry out any tests, even of small weapons, underground during a certain period of, say, 1 to 5 years, while we continue to discuss the question of how we could inspect on this part of the agreement, too, as well as the more general disarmament agreements that are made.
Well,
I think we have to make these agreements. We just can't possibly continue to go on in the great insecurity, the great national danger that we are in now.
Do you think that Mr. Khrushchev was completely sincere on his four-year general total disarmament proposal made before the United Nations?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think that if he were to be asked, do you think that this is going to come about, he might say the probability is rather small, because we have seen from the bomb test agreements how long it takes for the USSR and the United States and Great Britain to work out the details of any proposal. We can't expect that such a complex matter as general disarmament, including all weapons, be formulated.
Bows and arrows and everything. Yeah.
With the system of inspection in a satisfactory way, unless
this isn't
than
what
a,
he proposed,
a couple
though,
of
was
years.
It, really?
Well, he proposed that we cut down on all disarmaments by 25% a year, and in 4 years have achieved complete disarmament with a system of controls and inspection that was, of course, not specified. This is something that has to be worked out by negotiation.
Worked out after the disarmament begins.
I don't see any reason why, in case that the bomb test agreement is signed this year, which I trust it will be, there should not be a decrease by 25% in our national military budget and in the Russian military budget next year. I think that this could be done just by the President and Mr. Khrushchev saying, why don't we do it and save this money and put it to some better use. I don't believe that our national security would be impaired at all. I think, in fact, that we would be safer if we were to do this, and if the USSR were to do it. And I don't think that we would need more than Mr. Khrushchev's word about it. I think that they are eager enough, that the Russians are eager enough to save this money and to devote it to building this up the standards of living in the USSR, that they wouldn't take the chance of being caught at going back on their word during the first year of this four-year proposal.
Dr. Pauling, something occurs to me. What difference if we continue testing or not now? If we have 100,000 bombs and they have, as you say, 50,000, well, is this such a great gesture to decide now that we're no longer going to test any more bombs? Do we need any more?
Well, I don't think...
What about these existing stockpiles?
Yes.
Isn't that the...
Aren't they enough to do the job? Surely they are enough to do the job several times over, I'm sure. We have many times, perhaps I shouldn't say many times, several times the amount of nuclear bombs needed to destroy the world, to kill almost everybody if they were to be used at all efficiently. And I think the USSR has much more than would be enough to kill everybody on Earth. Now, why go on testing? Well, you know, there is talk about fighting limited wars. Perhaps we'd make an agreement with the Russians that we wouldn't use any bombs bigger than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, you know, that can only kill a small city, wipe out 100,000 or 200,000 people at once. And or perhaps even still smaller bombs, a half or a tenth the size.
Tactical bombs.
Tactical bombs. Now, it's much harder to build these little bombs and be sure that they will work than to build the big bombs. There's no doubt. If you want to make bombs small enough to be carried by a soldier, one bomb per man, with another one carrying a sort of bazooka that will fire it, and such bombs exist now. But if you want to make them of minimum weight and maximum certainty that they will explode, you have to carry out tests. This is a sort of engineering, gadgeteering that requires testing. The big bombs don't require any testing. There's also a point about the big bombs. If you want to save money on your rockets, you don't want the big bomb, the bomb that could destroy Moscow, to weigh twice as much as it needs to weigh. If you could engineer it, redesign it in such a way that it weighed only half as much and could be carried by half as big a rocket, you'd save a lot of money. Well, now, this means cutting close to the edge. You aren't sure that it will work if you change the design as much as that.
Further testing is required.
Well, if you want to save money, if you want to do a really efficient job of destroying the world, then you ought to continue the bomb tests.
Isn't that a little unfair, Dr. Pauling? If you want to do an efficient job of destroying the world, then you ought to continue the bomb test.
Not at all. I don't think it's unfair at all. I think this is just a realistic statement of what the situation is. I won't admit I don't think I'll give an inch on that.
Well, my point that I asked you about a moment ago, I didn't really ask, although my question perhaps wasn't phrased clearly. Why we must continue testing, I'm aware of what the Atomic Energy Commission has said and what the Pentagon holds to be necessary, but I wonder about the value of an agreement to stop further testing as long as these existing stockpiles continue to exist.
Yes. Well,
This is the question that I think might properly
be considered. I think it's a good thing that these stockpiles exist. You know, ever since I was a boy, I have been troubled by the question of morality, and especially morality and nationalism and war. I've tried to understand the world, and as the years have gone by, I have felt that I was getting a better and better understanding of the nature of the world, the physical world, chemical substances, and how they interact with one another, and how the atoms are arranged in the molecules, even human beings, what the structure of human beings is, and to some extent, why human beings behave the way that they do, in terms of the molecules out of which they are built. But all along I was troubled by one difficulty. When I was a boy, I heard orators say, it is your duty to go out and fight, kill as many of those wicked Germans as possible during the First World War. I wasn't old enough to enlist, but I heard these statements made. And of course, on Sunday, I would go to Sunday school and would read the commandment, thou shalt not kill. And this caused me a good bit of trouble. The whole business of patriotism and the duty of every American to lay down his life for his country, fighting the enemy, troubled me. I didn't see just what the logical arguments were. Why wasn't it sensible to settle questions, disputes between nations, by some method that didn't involve killing? Well, you know, I finally found what the answer was. It is that nations have been and are immoral, in that they have relied upon war, the immorality of war, and it has just been a part of the process of evolution of society, of civilization, that this institution of war has developed. Many people have known, everybody has known, that it was wrong to kill people, wrong to use force in order to get your way. And yet, the world has been such that nobody has seen how to get rid of war. Well, now, the extraordinary event has occurred in the evolution of the world that we have got ourselves into the position, through the development of these nuclear weapons, that we have to give up war. It no longer makes sense for the USSR to go to war when, no matter how the USSR were to wage the war to attack the United States, she would be destroyed. The Russian people would be killed. It no longer would make sense for the United States to go to war when we know that it would end up with our nation being destroyed too. Perhaps a few million people left. And so our situation is that this great immorality of war is going to be eliminated from the world right now. We've got into the position in the world where we are forced to do this, and I am very glad that we have got into this position.
We're going to remove it.
I like morality. I don't like the idea of killing people. I don't like the idea that our great nation would force the rest of the world to do something that it doesn't want to do.
How do you consider this a moral act? It has nothing to do with morality, our abolishment of war.
Why not?
Well, it's a consequence of fear.
Yes,
it isn't
surely
a moral
or
right. positive act, is it?
Surely, you see, the situation might have come about that the development of nuclear weapons would force us into greater immorality. I don't think that it is anything predestined, foreordained, that this development, which is the result of the work of scientists, Professor Fermi here at the University of Chicago, very great man, a great loss to the world that he should have died, that this development has been such as to cause the world to become moral. This is a matter, this wasn't foreordained. It is just good luck that the development of nuclear weapons, the existence of these great nuclear stockpiles, requires that nations now become moral. Human beings are moral. I think human beings are good, you know. I like human beings, I like people, and I think that they are good. Once in a while they get crazy, of course, and to do bad things. But in general, human beings are good, and it is only nations that have represented the great immorality in the world. Now,
Dr.
I think
Pauling,
it's a
I'm
fine
sorry.
Thing. A fine thing that this fear requires that we give up war. It's a fine thing that nuclear weapons are on the side of morality.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Pauling. I'm sorry, but our time is up.
Well,
I've enjoyed talking with you very much, and thank you, sir. This is Frank Reynolds. I'll be back again next Sunday morning at the same time.